Hello and welcome to the podcast of Vineyard Church here in Maryville, Tennessee. We post our Sunday messages here each week, as well as our conversations episodes, which include interviews, special announcements, and in-depth teaching. You can visit vineyardchurch.us to learn more about us or to access the audio archive. You can also subscribe to this podcast on Spotify, Apple, or Google Podcasts. And now, here's the episode.
One of the things I want to point out is in this section, Paul is affectionate to the point of being sappy. Like, I read it and I get uncomfortable. Like, if any of you guys talk to me like that, I would avoid eye contact and probably ignore you for a couple of weeks. Like, he really lays it on thick. And the NLT, read from the CSB earlier. We'll bounce back and forth actually a little bit today, but in the NLT, it really brings it out well. Let me read to you 1 Thessalonians 2:17-20. It says, "Dear brothers and sisters, after we were separated from you for a little while, though our hearts never left you, we tried very hard to come back because of our intense longing to see you." Again, he is not playing it cool, man. Like, he is going for it. That word intense longing, it's actually the Greek word epithymia. It essentially means epidesire. It's usually translated lust. Now, obviously there's nothing remotely sexual going on here at all, but again, he's laying it all out. Like, he is not playing it cool at all. Verse 18, "We wanted very much to come to you, and I, Paul, tried again and again, but Satan prevented us." I would love to know that backstory, but we don't get it. Verse 19, "After all, what gives us hope and joy and what will be our proud reward and crown as we stand before our Lord Jesus when he returns? It is you. Yes, you are our pride and joy." If my own dad talked to me like that, I would probably tell him to back off and be like, "Okay, Dad, I know you're proud of me. Don't make it weird." You know, like, he is really diving in. But the point here actually really matters, which is that these people, they're not a side gig for Paul. He's not guarding his heart. He's not holding back. It's a good spot, actually, for me to clarify something from last week where I said we should be wary of those who flatter us. We should be mindful of that. True. Don't want to take that back. But that doesn't mean we should be wary of all those who encourage us. All right? Paul said clearly that he was not using flattery. We saw that. But here you can see he's going out of his way to encourage them. That's the tricky part. I think the only difference between flattery and encouragement is intent. It could be the exact same words, but in flattery, those words are about selfish gain. And in encouragement, those words are about lifting someone up. So please don't stop lifting one another up. We're good at that. Let's be even better at that. And here again, we see Paul is really laying it on thick. And to be clear, like, Paul is not, best I can tell, I mean, I didn't know him personally, obviously, but he's not some cuddly, warm and fuzzy kind of guy. Honestly, if you've read the New Testament much, then you would know that's John, actually. You read the Gospel of John, you read John's letters, it's dearly beloved this and blessed family that, and that's his mode. That's not Paul. Paul's a total nerd, okay? He's got this razor-sharp mind, and he's focused on precision, and he's focused on clarity, and when you're focused on things like that, then like hugs and cuddles just kind of muddle the water. And yet his affection here is real, and it's unmistakable. We'd be mindful of, there's a guardedness that if we leave it unchecked, can rob us of real community. I mean, some of you in the room, you're just so open and vulnerable that anyone can have direct, unfettered, total access to your heart any moment of any day. Others of you, on the other hand, are Fort Knox. Nobody gets in there. Nobody gets close. Probably there's wisdom somewhere in between. But we can be so guarded that we shut people out. We could be so self-protective that we miss out on a depth of community. And we live in the real world, guys. I know that we cannot, like, roll deep with every single person who steps into our lives. I don't mean to imply that. To some people, Jesus said, come and follow me. And to others, he said, go and sin no more. So like maybe we can do the same at times. But there are some cases that God invites us to just step all in. Just all into the beauty and the mess that inevitably comes with genuine, deep, true community. Last week, we talked about trust and how hard it can be to earn trust and to gain it, about the inherent risk in investing your trust in someone. And I'm in all of that. I don't want to take any of it back. But sometimes we have to lean all the way in, even with the risk. And to love anybody requires risk. I read you a quote, one of the better quotes, which is really saying a lot, from C.S. Lewis, a really good one. He said this: to love at all is to be vulnerable. Love anything and your heart will be wrung and possibly broken. If you want to make sure of keeping it intact, you must give it to no one, not even an animal. Wrap it carefully round with hobbies and little luxuries. Avoid all entanglements. Lock it up safe in the casket or coffin of your selfishness. But in that casket, safe, dark, motionless, airless, it will change. It will not be broken. It will become unbreakable, impenetrable, irredeemable. To love is to be vulnerable. So there's this inherent risk. It's like I can't love any of you without putting myself at some inevitable risk that comes with it. And what we've seen already, and we're going to see more in the coming verses, is that Paul was in agony precisely because he loved the Thessalonians so much. He was wrung out on their behalf, and he was paying the price for that love that he had for them, and there's no regard for that. So hopefully you'll remember from a few weeks ago, this will ring a bell. If not, here's a new thought, but I taught about the difference between empathy and sympathy. Empathy is mostly seen, at least now, as the meanings of words have shifted a little bit. Empathy is mostly seen as like a huge upgrade on sympathy, and sympathy has kind of been redefined as something that's more like pity, something that's detached and distant. But you'll remember, I hope, that we saw the actual biblical word is sympathy. And in fact, sympathy, or its Latin-based equivalent, which is compassion, are the words that are most often used to describe the emotions of Jesus. Again and again, we see his sympathy, we see his compassion. Now, this word, it's tricky because different people mean different things when they use these words, and it's changing constantly. It's kind of a mess. It's gotten politicized in a weird and unexpected way. But to know what I'm driving at here, again, I'm reminding you, the scenario we looked at was someone stuck in quicksand. You guys remember that? So picture someone in quicksand. For me, my default picture of quicksand is always from The Princess Bride, right? Swamp forest and... is it the fire forest? Fire swamp. Thank you. I knew someone's going to know. Also, if I hadn't corrected it, someone would be like, he didn't say that right. I get it. Okay. So yeah, picture the fire swamp and the rodents of unusual size walking around, and then someone stuck in the quicksand. Empathy, at least as some people are defining it, it seems like, says that if you don't jump in with both feet, then you're not really loving. But the trouble is, to state the obvious, is that now if you jump in with both feet, now you're both sinking now and there's no way out. But sympathy, on the other hand, says you can enter into their suffering, you can genuinely step into what they're facing, you can get in that quicksand, but you also stay anchored in some way onto the solid ground so that you can actually help pull people out. In the Princess Bride scenario, of course, Wesley dove in after Buttercup, right? But what did he do first, remember? He took the vine. Yeah, he grabbed the vine and then he dove in so that he had a way out. This is what we're talking about. The late Dr. Timothy Keller did a sermon on this same text, and it was way better than the one I'm giving you now, but I'm doing my best. He was a remarkable preacher, but he said this so very clearly. He said, Paul gave all of his heart to the Thessalonians without losing his head. He gave all of his heart to the Thessalonians without losing his head. I mean, Paul's so endeared to these people, man. He's not holding back. He's so all in that the reality is Paul's happiness is irrevocably connected to their well-being. If they weren't okay, he wasn't going to be okay. We'll get back to the text now. Verse 5 of chapter 3, he says this: "That is why, when I could bear it no longer, I sent Timothy to find out whether your faith was still strong." So remember, he left them in the midst of a crisis, and he's been really concerned about their well-being ever since. "I was afraid that the tempter had gotten the best of you and that our work had been useless. But now Timothy has just returned, bringing us good news about your faith and your love. He reports that you always remember our visit with joy, that you want to see us as much as we want to see you. So we have been greatly encouraged in the midst of our troubles and suffering, dear brothers and sisters, because you have remained strong in your faith." And listen to the strength of verse 8 here. It gives us new life to know that you are standing firm in the Lord. He's going, we can breathe again. Paul, I can breathe again. I have life again because now I know your faith is strong. So again, genuine investment in the souls of others, total buy-in. But the trick is not giving away your heart. For some of us, it's hard not to do that. It's easy to give away your heart. It's giving away your heart without losing your head. All right? Let's look at Paul's very next words, and you can see that he has done that. Verse 8 through 10, "For now we live, if you stand firm in the Lord," we're in the CSB now. "How can we thank God for you in return for all the joy we experience before our God because of you? As we pray very earnestly night and day to see you face to face," and look at this, "and to complete what is lacking in your faith." I mean, so warm and fuzzy and cuddly and dear, sweet, precious you. I am so glad that dear, sweet, precious you is doing so great, because now that means we can get to work on the stuff that needs to be better. Yeah, that's what he's keeping his head. They have his whole heart. He's keeping his head. The more literal translation here, it actually would be, "I can't wait to come so that I can address your shortcomings." Paul's love is not the surfacey kind where you just want people to feel warm and fuzzy no matter what. That's ultimately selfish. It's more sincere than that. It's the kind where you care enough to help even if it's hard, even if you have to say the hard thing. You've heard about him before. He's becoming famous around here, but we have a dog named Tyson, and Tyson's a cockapoo, because we are suckers who paid more for a designer breed. He's not a rescue, no. We like to say he rescued us. He rescued us from having too much money. We got a designer breed, and you can judge, but I've been to a lot of your houses, a lot of you, a lot of poos in this, a lot of bougie dogs in this church. I'll tell you that, a lot of real fancy dogs. Anyway, we got one of those. And he's fine. He's rude to strangers, but he's harmless. Unless you're a decorative throw pillow, in which case real danger is coming. But other than that, good dog. We love him a lot. We really do. Probably too much, I think. We love him a lot. But as I've told you before, for Sharon, it's this whole other thing, okay? It's this whole other world of affection. We got Tyson, and Sharon, young and beautiful, became a grandmother overnight. Just instantly became, her whole personality changed. She has spoiled that dog from day one, and hear me, he's worse now because of it, full stop. And Sharon knows this, totally unapologetic about the whole thing. And then one day, I sort of tentatively confronted her. I was like, come on, why do you spoil this dog? You didn't do that with your own kids. What gives? And then Sharon, as she often does, proceeded to completely win the argument because she said this. She goes, yeah, of course I didn't do this with the kids. If they're spoiled, it ruins their lives. And then we release these entitled little monsters onto an unsuspecting world. I could never do that to our kids. But if I spoil the dog, then we just have a spoiled dog, and who cares? I was like, she's right. But here, think about it, though, as we just go one layer deeper. Here's what she was really saying. What she was really saying is, I spoil the dog and not the kids because I don't love him as much as I do the kids. And he isn't as important to me or to the world as our children are. And she's right. She can give Tyson her heart and her head, and it doesn't matter. But the kids really, really have her heart. And that's precisely why she can't and won't lose her head. Paul loved the Thessalonians so much that he was willing and even eager, it seems, to do the hard work required to help them grow, to help them improve. And anything less than that isn't really love, I think. Certainly not the best version of it. All right, so back to ripping off Tim Keller's sermon on this. He made a really, really good point, as he always did. He said there's a huge difference between power and influence. Power is external, and it's pressed upon us externally. So it's a way of creating impact based on outside forces. So things like money or policy or commerce or just brute strength, okay? People with lots of power can, from the outside, impact the way other people live their lives. So power is external, but influence is internal. It brings change from the inside out. Power is outside in, but influence is where someone impacts you in such a way that you change, not because your force is being pressed upon them, but you've transformed the way they move out into the world, and that influence you bring upon them comes from the inside out. And Paul was, by any worldly measure, completely powerless. I mean, certainly he was empowered by the Holy Spirit in incredible ways, but in terms of anything the world would call power, he had none. No money, no clout, no political backing, no force, no access to force. He had no raw power at all. And yet, Paul was one of the most influential people who have ever lived. One of a handful of the most influential, world-changing people who have ever... People with tremendous raw power can only dream of having like a Pauline level of influence on others. How? Well, it goes back to the same idea. Like if you think about, your favorite teacher growing up, people talk about their best teacher they ever had, the one that, what do they talk about? They talk about someone who cared about you personally, and it was never the easiest class, was it? Those are your favorite classes, the ones where it was fun and they didn't ask you to do anything. But the teachers who really changed you, they were the ones who loved you and they pushed you to be better, right? For me in school, that was Dr. Bowdell. Same deal. Both of those things, hardest teacher I ever had, best teacher I ever had, changed more than any teacher ever did. I think you talk about a coach, same type of thing, a coach who really made an impact. They cared about you personally, but then they pushed you to be better. I didn't actually have a coach like that growing up. It's probably why I didn't make the NBA. It's probably the only reason. I had nothing to do with a gross lack of talent. I'm so slow, but I move and I don't move. They just go right by me. Anyway, that's another subject. I was lucky enough to have two parents, by the way, who did both of those things. They cared about me. They invested in me. They also both challenged me to be better. We see this in Paul. This is how he changed the world. He loved them enough to give them his heart, but he kept his head. So think about it. If you give people your head, but not your heart, you can't influence them because they'll know you don't care, and you'll probably just be mean. If you give them your heart and your head, you can't influence them because you won't have the courage to challenge them. You need them to like you so much. Because they have your heart and your head, you can't possibly say the difficult thing. But if you give them your heart and you keep your head, you can actually love them well. And that's how Paul changed the world. And that's hard because it's like we're not celebrated for saying hard things in many cases. I'm sure, like, the Thessalonians were so happy to get a letter from Paul. They love Paul. They're like, great, we got a letter from Paul. And they open it up, and it's like, oh, Paul just told me to go get a job and to only have sex with the person I'm married to. That's just a little preview of where we're going in the next couple of weeks. They read that and go, oh, thanks a lot, Paul. Awesome. But that's why he had influence. Our sort of weird, divisive, intense cultural moment that we find ourselves in is just, It is crying for, it is begging for people to give their hearts and keep their heads. Like, things are elevated. I mean, obviously, right? I feel like we've been sort of elevated for, I don't know, a long time. But then there's a real spike. It's intense right now. There's a lot of fear and reactivity and lots of anger and news that's mostly not news. It's mostly rage baiting, right? And it's just flooding our feeds, man, like open sewers. And people that you love are drowning in it right now. Right? People you love, like people you're all in, man, and they're drowning in it right now. And if you would like to help them, I'm assuming you would because you love them so much. If you would like to help them, that means you can't be drowning in it too. There's a good chance that some of you, maybe many of you are. There's a vicious cycle with this stuff, right? But, you know, social anxiety and hysteria, they crank up. And as a result, more people need help. And because of that same social anxiety and hysteria, fewer of us are able to help. Because we get sucked in it too, man. In the world, not of it, guys, right? Like, that was Jesus's prayer for us, his command to us. In the world, not of it. I said a few weeks ago, I told you I'm largely offline and I'm almost entirely disengaged politically. And I want to be very clear, like, that's not for everyone. That's not like a commandment. I'm just part of the way I roll, okay? And the truth is, we definitely need a lot more godly people who are more politically engaged, not less. Who are more engaged in what's going, more aware of the comings and goings. I'm when I tell you that, I'm not telling you to be like me. But I can tell you why I do that. It's because I know my own limitations. And I know that I can get sucked right in. And if I can be more direct about it, like, I can't be sucked in to that vortex and still do my job, be your pastor. Because especially in times like this, I have to help pull people out, which means I can't be drowning in it in myself. And I think that's true for all of us, at least to some extent. Doesn't mean you handle it like I do, but that's why I handle it that way. You know, there's a difference, we've talked about this before, but there's a difference between patience and self-control. Patience is what kicks in when you still have emotional margin, you know? When you've got, okay, I can handle this much, okay? And patience is how much you can, if you have a lot of patience, you can handle this much. If you have a lot of patience, you can, if you're me, anyway, if you have patience, this is how much you can handle. And when you run out of that, self-control kicks in, okay? You run out of patience, now it's time to exercise self-control. And self-control is like a muscle that fatigues with use, man. And here's what's happening. I mean, all over the place. People, before they get out of bed, they are doom scrolling the news. They're reading this angry post and that. They're fixating and brooding on the people that they're angry with. And as a result, that patience is gone before their feet even hit the floor. So what's that mean? That means they're running on self-control the rest of the day. Nothing but self-control from there on out. And how long does yours last? At some point, it snaps. At some point, it breaks, and you post that thing, or say that thing, or kick the dog, or yell at your kids, or whatever it is. And like, I don't know about you, but I'm just talking about me. But for me, when things are really elevated, and things are really toxic, just in the discourse, like, I've got to recalibrate. Because I'm not good enough to be running on the fumes of self-control before my feet hit the ground. If so, I will fail as a father, as a husband, as a pastor, as everything. I don't have it. So I got to keep some slack in the line, man. I got to have some emotional margin. So what that means is I got to start turning dials. I have to turn down media consumption, and I have to turn up prayer. And if I don't, it won't work. If I don't, I'll fall short. And I know because I have, and I do. But I gotta start re-slicing my time pie. Maybe you're a whole lot better than me at that, and it's not necessary. But for most of us, I think probably it is, at least to some degree. So turning down the consumption of media, turning up time in prayer. I'm not asking you to be ignorant. I'm not asking you to stick your head in the sand. I'm asking you to keep your head out of the sewer. You know what I'm saying? Because people are scared, and they are panicked, and they are catastrophizing, and they're trapped in their own echo chambers. There's like real nationalized trauma right now, and it's impacting every single person. I mean, we're swimming in it, for crying out loud. No one's exempt. And the people around you need you to give you their heart. Wait, need you to give them your heart. There we go. Because it's so easy not to. It's so easy to just respond with frustration and angst. Oh, people like that. People in that political tribe or that sort of worldview. It's those types of people. And look, yeah, I mean, I don't know. You're probably right. Great. But you know what? This is just what people do. Time immemorial. There's nothing unique about this moment in that regard. When anxiety and stress and fear go up, people, out of sheer fear and panic, they run to a clan, they get deeply embedded in that tribe, and they start throwing stones at everybody else. It's what everybody's done. And no, it's not right, but can we give them enough of our heart to realize that's human nature? We have some compassion for that. This is what people do when they're afraid, because it's what people have always done when they're afraid, and hopefully that helps you keep your head and realize these people who are sequestered off in their echo chambers and their clans, and they keep saying things progressively dumber and dumber. Can you keep your head, maintain compassion, and recognize these people need comfort, they need peace, they need hope? And if it's not going to come from us, where's it going to come from? Give them our hearts. Keep our heads. Okay, I'm almost done here, but I want to jump ahead of one last pushback that I think some people might have, which is, you know, I'm talking about being fully emotionally invested. I'm talking about all of the affection and just, I mean, Paul's flat out precious to these Thessalonians. And there might be some being like, all right, good for Paul. I'm not the type. Like, I'm not the comforting type. All the affection and all the sappiness from Paul in this text, that it makes me uncomfortable, okay? And I'm glad he can be like that, but I'm not like that, and I'm not going to fake it, right? Like, probably in the room. You know, someone who goes, all right, if somebody needs somebody to pet them, that's fine. They just got to go somewhere else. That's not me. Okay. I hear you, and please don't fake anything. But you might have some stereotypes about being comforting and compassionate that aren't entirely true. I want to tell you about the guy who is, in practice, my pastor, has been for a long time. The person who I go to when I am conflicted or I am grieving or I'm just at a loss, I go to him every time. And this guy is not even a little bit lovey-dovey. He's the opposite of whatever. Like, he is direct. He gives these short, absolute answers that leaves no room left for debate. That's the norm for him. He and I have very little in common. He reads widely. He's a total nerd. He reads widely about things that I don't even find remotely interesting. He's a pastor at another church far away. His sermons are fine. There's nothing especially engaging. It's not my style. I disagree with him sharply about some pretty significant theological issues. We disagree politically, too, for whatever that's worth. He's not warm. In fact, he's really pretty cold. He does not like giving compliments. He hates being complimented. And he does not like physical contact. And some of his personality quirks make him come off as flat out rude. And when I am scared or frustrated or in grief or stuck or just confused, I reach out to him first every single time. You know why? Because I know he loves me. He always picks up the phone and he tells me the truth. And if he thinks that I won't like it when he tells me the truth, he tells me anyway. Because it's not about him. It never has been. It's always been about me, because he loves me. He loves me too much to not point out my blind spots. He means the world to me. Why? Because he gives me his heart without losing his head. The most unlikely personality type has been by far my most cherished pastoral voice. 20 plus years, he's been my ride or die, like my go-to, man. I think he's hugged me once, and that was only after I cried a lot, like for a while. And I think finally it's like, oh, grief, you know, he finally hugged me. I don't actually know what Paul's personality type was like. I mean, maybe he was the touchy-feely type, even though my best guess is that he wasn't, okay? But the point that I'm making is this isn't a matter of personality type. It's a matter of Christian character. Don't hide behind, you know, your persona. And keep in mind, it's not ridiculous to say that Paul has influenced this world as much as anyone in history other than Jesus himself. I don't know how to quantify that, but that might literally be true. And in the end, it's clear why. He loves people so intensely that no reasonable person could ever doubt it. And then he spoke the truth, even if it was hard, from that place of love. Again, he gave his heart. He kept his head.